Welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Throneberry, and this is a special program dedicated to the stories that we recorded on September 25th at our There I Was open mic for veterans evening here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We hope that you will enjoy these stories, and if it's something that you're interested in, you can always send me an email to dale@veteransradio.net, and I'd be more than happy to tell you how we set up the program for you. I want to remind everybody that you are listening to Veterans Radio and that we are brought to you by Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. And for more information, you can go to their website, that's legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 800-693-4800. U.S. Wings, manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets in the world. U.S. Wings is a major supplier of leather flight jackets to the military. For more information, go to their website, uswings.com, or give them a call at 800-650-0659. I also want to remind you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and enter into the drawing for their newest military jacket that we're going to be giving away at the end of November in our benefits program here on Veterans Radio. It's a Top Gun leather flight jacket, and it's worth well over $800. So go to veteransradio.net and click to enter into the drawing for that jacket. I think you're going to be amazed when you see what it looks like. And of course, we also want to thank our local veteran service organizations here in Ann Arbor. That's American Legion Post 46, the Charles S. Kettles VVA Post 310, and of course, VFW Post 423, where we record our There I Was programs on the last Wednesday of every month. So I want you to sit back and enjoy There I Was. We want to welcome you to Veterans Radio sponsoring There I Was, open mic night for veterans here at the VFW 423 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What we've been doing over the last couple of months is telling stories, and this is why we want you all here and want you listening to these stories. We are talking tonight about advanced training. What that is, that, you know, once you got out of basic, where did you go? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we'll give each of you an opportunity to address your particular story. And I'll kind of start off and kind of give you an idea of what I'm looking for. My name is Dale Throneberry, by the way. I was a chief warrant officer in the United States Army in 1967 to 71. After going to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, I ended up at Fort Walters, Texas at primary flight school. And as what they called a warrant officer candidate. And the training was called, my initial status was that of a snowbird. And I was a snowbird because I couldn't fly. Made sense, right? But the first 4 weeks of training in this warrant officer candidate program was our officer training period. And so 4 weeks we learned all about the different things of being a real live officer. And we had to memorize we had to salute and do all those things. We had to eat square meals, and which was kind of, you know, the stuff where you don't look at the plate and get it all thrown into you. The highlight of my snowbird experience was meeting my best friend ever, and that turned out to be Ray Schrader. Ray was from New Jersey as well as I am, and I met him the first night as a snowbird when I arrived at 2 in the morning, and they just threw me into the, you know, the bay, and evidently I woke him up, and this curse came out of the top bunk, and it was a very thick Jersey accent to the point of something along the lines like, "What the hell are you doing? Who is this? What do you want?" And I'm going, "What?" I hadn't lost my Jersey accent yet either, so it's like, "Well, you're looking at me, you're talking to me," and I was like, "Hey, I'm walking here," and I just, "Where are you from?" He goes, "I'm from Point Pleasant, New Jersey." "What? My grandfather lives in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. I was born the next town over." "Oh, yeah, yeah." Next thing, no, that was it. Best friends for forever after that. So during snowbird school, you go, as I mentioned before, you learn all the things about military justice and so on and so forth. And another little experience I remember was that Ray's mom sent him a box of brownies. And we weren't allowed to have any of that stuff during flights, you know, during that
part of the program. And so the TAC officer, who was a warrant officer as well, but had already done a tour in Vietnam, said, okay, do you have enough to feed the whole platoon? And we said, no, because there's 60 guys in the platoon. And he says, okay, then you and your bunkmate here, you two New Jersey idiots, you guys have to eat all of these right now. So, you know, of course, we're immediately sick after that. But so after the 4 weeks, now we go up to the hill, is what they call it. And up on the hill is where all the different flight schools, flight classes were. And there were what they called warrant officers, there were WARWACs, and then there were ORWACs. And the ORWACs were already officers. So they were already, you know, most of them were first lieutenants. And the other companies up there were all warrant officer candidates. And so we go up to the hill, and I was what they called a red hat. And within a couple of days, we went out onto the flight line for the very first time. And the aircraft that I was assigned to was an OH-23, which was built prior to the Korean War, I think. And they never even seen one. and so to describe how this flight thing actually works is, and many of you have seen the helicopter here in our grounds, there are four main controls in a helicopter. There's a cyclic that controls going forward and backward and sideways and so forth, like that. There is the collective, which is on your left side, which is like a throttle, and you pull up on that throttle, and it tilts the blades and takes a little bit bigger bite out of the air so you can actually get off the ground. Now, the OH-23 was not a didn't have any computers in it, so, and it didn't have a governor on it. So this was all manual. You had to turn on the power like a motorcycle, and as you pulled in power, you had to increase more power because otherwise the power would bleed off and the blade would stop turning, which is never a good thing. And as you did that, you had your feet on pedals. This is why it's good to be in one of these little chairs, right? So every time you would pull in power, you had to put in a pedal because the tail rotor had to be adjusted because the helicopter wanted to spin around its axis. So if you didn't have the tail rotor pedals there, if you pulled in power, the blades would go this way and the body of the helicopter would go in direct opposite notion. So they take us out to this training field, out in the middle of nowhere, Texas, someplace near a place called Possum Kingdom Lake, which I can only imagine what the fun was out there. And but I can remember that my instructor, he said, okay, you know, one of the guys had to get out. So he says, you're first Thornsburg or whatever he called me. And he says, okay, get in a seat. And all right. So I'm in there, and we go out into this field, and he starts giving us these instruments. You know, he says, okay, you've got the cyclic, and I have the cyclic. So, you know, and I'm trying to keep it. He says, keep it steady. I'll do everything else. You just keep it steady. And so I'm squeezing this thing to death, and I'm going like, you know, and of course you're overcorrecting all the time. And so you would see all these helicopters all over this field, and they're going like this forward and backwards and sideways and everything, and then it would stop. And then you knew that the instructor had taken the controls again. And then he says, okay, finally figure that out. So then you got to do the collective along with the cyclic. And so every time you did them like this, you had to make a correction over here. So the next thing you know, you can see these helicopters bouncing up in the air and down. It looked like a big, giant square dance. You know, do-si-do, because they're going like this, too. They're not steady. They're going forward, backwards. They're going sideways, up and down. And then a couple of them are spinning around. And so he gives you the next control, which are the pedals. And so he says, okay, now you just do the pedals for a while, and I'll do the other. I'll hold everything steady. You just do the pedals. So we're doing the pedals, and you find yourself starting to drift kind of like this slowly. As you can't figure out which one that you're supposed to push in what direction. So after that, we do that switch out, and then everybody goes, and we just keep practicing that maneuver every day. And then suddenly, I don't know what it is, but there's something that goes off in your brain that says, you don't have to wrestle with this thing. Just treat it nice, you know? And so that's finally what happened. Instead of doing this with my hand, my fist closed around the cyclic control, I just held it with two fingers. And suddenly everything started moving the way I wanted it to. And I thought, oh, this is awesome. I can do this stuff. And every day we had a little check ride to make sure that we didn't screw up something or we didn't fly into a tree or somewhere along those lines, which was not uncommon. Because you would go back to the main heliport and you'd have a couple of hundred helicopters trying to land at the same time, all being piloted by 20-year-old idiots who, you know, don't know what they're doing, because you have to, when you call the tower at the airport, you have to let go of something to change the frequency. And so you just learn to cross your legs real tight, your knees around the cyclic, and reach up and go one number at a time, and then hopefully that you'll get the right one. So after 4 weeks of doing all this stuff where I finally was able not to kill myself, and I guess the instructor felt a little bit brave, we're out at the training field, and we land, and he gets out. And so, where are you going? He says, no, you're gone. You know, just take it around yourself. Who? You can do this. I know you can do it. Don't worry about it. Just take off by yourself. And he walks away. And you go, where are you going? And I said, okay, I can do this. And so it's like, again, there's all these rituals in there. So I had to look at the tower, give them the high sign and all, and they said, go ahead, take it off. So I did it, took off, everything went fine, went around three times, landed it three times, didn't hit anybody, land on anybody. He comes in, sticks his head in, he says, take it back to the main heliport. By myself? You're always there. No, you can do it. So as I'm doing this in a rush fashion, I ended up in this daisy chain of helicopters at 500 feet going 0 miles an hour. Because like the chain, you know, when you used to do skating with the whip kind of thing, you know, this was it. And I was at the end of it. So I'm sitting there. This helicopter is making so much noise because I've got it cranked up as loud, far as it will go and not redline. And so he finally says, okay, and the guy says, you're clear to land. And as I start to land, this helicopter comes over the top of me, literally over the top of me, bounces on the big H in the middle of the field, comes up, goes over the top of other helicopters, puts it down in another parking spot. The instructor gets out, and all I can see is him doing, you know, like this at the kid. And so that was my introduction to flying a helicopter. There'll be more to follow, because the helicopter was an awesome magic carpet. So thank you for listening. All right, moving right along. Oh, we've got Scott back here. So Scott Brooks Miller is... it's a Marine. So Scott's going to be talking to us. He was a sergeant in the Marines, 1968 to 1973, and we want to welcome Scott back because he's had a few medical issues over the last couple of months, it seems like. And yes, I did take a little divot out of his face, but I think he looks good, don't you?
Better.
Well, I was told that women like guys with cool scars.
One of you cool guys.
Yes. All right, you're on.
Okay. I've finished boot camp. I've finished ITR, and I am off to track vehicle school. I am now approximately 17 and 4.5 months old, and I'm excited. I have absolutely no automotive background, mechanical background, nothing. You know, I was an altar boy, so I guess that's what prepared me for track vehicle school. I get to Del Mar at Camp Pendleton. It's got a neat little harbor, and that's where the track vehicle school was for decades. And we had a class of about 40, 42 people, and we're introduced to some basic concepts. We're taught to drive self-propelled artillery units, tanks, LVTs, landing vehicle track, ANTOSes. We were talking about this earlier. ANTOSes were this really small track vehicle that had 6 106 recoilless rifles, three on each side, had a crew of three, and it was powered by a 383 Chrysler Hemi. and you got that thing on the beach and opened it up, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. So, and that's basically about the first 2 weeks of track vehicle school. My MOS was track vehicle repair, self-propelled artillery. So for the remainder of the 10 weeks I was there, fully indoctrinated on the M109 self-propelled howitzer. 155, the turret could turn 360 degrees, had a crew of four. When you change the oil, you just basically lift the engine out. And it just, it was amazing, the simplicity of maintenance on the vehicle. And track vehicle repair was broken into five echelons. The crews were allowed to check the oil and check the fluid levels in the final drive and the batteries. The track vehicle repairman attached to that battery could do second echelon maintenance, which is, replace parts basically. And when I first got my first experience overseas was third echelon maintenance. But because I was 17 and non-deployable, where am I going with this? I'm 17 years old and I'm running around driving, 25 ton vehicles, and a couple times we'd bounce off each other, and it was a hoot. I mean, it was a lot of fun. And if I could have bought an Antos, I would have one now. You didn't have to worry about EMPs on any of these pieces of equipment. Phenomenal toys. And it was surreal. A lot, we were all 17 or 18. We were all really, really young. And, my first sensation, I mean, boot camp, is temporary. Some of these guys that I went through track vehicle school with, I am still friends with today. I have a real good buddy that lives up in Flint. No, he's finally realized after 40 years he's got to move, buying a house up in Grand Blanc, and we'll be leaving Flint in the rearview mirror. What can I say? I just had fun. I wouldn't realize the importance of what I was learning until the following year, but that 12 weeks that I was there, learning how to take track apart and putting it back together and replacing final drives and batteries and starters and generators and, on the turrets, replenishing the nitrogen for the recoil mechanisms, and it was a hoot. I learned a lot. I am now very mechanically inclined, though I can't move. So, all for waste. Anyway, that's about it. Okay. All right. Any hard pressing questions?
Any questions for Scott?
Yes.
What's an EMT?
EMT or LVT? LVT. LVT is an Amtrak. The Marine Corps pioneered Amtraks before the Second World War. The Marine Corps required its first LVT-1 in 1939. And during the course of World War II, they went to the LVT-1, the LVT-2, and the LVT-3. The LVT-4, I don't know what happened to it. It evolved into an LVT-5 during the Vietnam War. They looked like big shoe boxes, and the back dropped, and you could get 16 guys with gear in there. And when you drop off, we got to do this. So they take you on LST out into the ocean about 1,000 yards off the beach, and you would drive off the front ramp, and you would literally submerge below water. And when you bounce back, and when you could see daylight around the periscopes that surrounded the commander's hatch, then you knew it was safe to open the turret, open the hatch. And off the coast there at Del Mar, it was reported there were numerous LVTs. because anyway, I was glad I never had to pursue a career in that line of work. The LVT was replaced by the LVT-7, which they're still using today. You'll see pictures of them, like when they went into Baghdad. It's got kind of it's got a bow and it kind of pushes up, and they're like three or four times faster than the old LVT-5. The LVT-5, the tracks were, probably 15 inches with a 3-inch depth, and in the water, that's how they got through the water. So they weren't real fast moving. The LVT-7 is jet propulsed. They take water in on intake and then they jet it out the back. So they're pretty fast. I was just reading where the Marine Corps is now doing research and development on the next generation. The first LVT was accepted into Camp Pendleton at the Track Vehicle School in March of 1973. And my major woke me up and said, we've got to unload a track. And I'd never seen one of these things before. And I had no idea, I had to figure out within a couple of minutes how to start it. And it had a joystick, so I was already familiar with that from other track vehicles. But I unloaded the first LVT at Camp Pendleton. That gives me a good National Defense Service Medal.
We got Larry's actually going to participate this time. So Larry, come on up. Larry is a CB from 66 to 68, and he ended up as an E4.
Well, like everybody else, unlike everybody else, quiet over there, Marine. I wasn't drafted. I joined when I was in high school. So when I got back from boot camp, my next duty station was a senior in high school. So I made it through high school. And in 66, I went to the Philadelphia Naval Guard to get my orders. Chief Petty Officer come up and give me a piece of paper and said, well, there's three lines here. Where do you want your duty station? And when I was promised when I joined as a junior, Hollyloch, Scotland, Rota, Spain, I put Hollyloch, Scotland, Rota, Spain, and then I thought, Brisbane, Australia. That's where the CB base was in World War II. I want to go there. Gave it to the chief petty officer. He looked at it, laughed and laughed, and crossed out all three of them and put Vietnam, Vietnam, Vietnam. He said, after all, you're a CB, right? And I said, yeah. He says, well, all the CBs are going to Vietnam, so join your brothers. So didn't have any choice. I ended up in Port Hueneme, California. When I got my orders, I thought, Port Humanumi. I'm going to Port Humanumi, California. Where in the heck is that? And they said, well, that's Hawaiian. It's Hueneme. And so that was one of the CB training bases. I went to a Class A school, 8 weeks, to train to be a utilities man, which is either a plumber, water treatment specialist, air conditioning. So I spent 8 weeks training there. Well, my battalion got orders to Vietnam. During that time, we were training, doing our military training at Camp Pendleton with the Marines. That's where we trained. We spent 3 weeks in Camp Pendleton. In the meantime, I was still going to school, and my battalion shipped out to Vietnam, to Da Nang. I finished my training. We also had mock villages on our base where you train there with the Marines. They would come over. We would search a village with the Marines, and they show us how to do it, because after all, we were Navy. It was an experience. Learned to use the M14 grenade launcher just like the regular Marines. Never saw a ship in my life the whole time I was in the service. A boat, ship, whatever you want to call them. And my next experience was flying commercial to Vietnam to join my battalion. So I didn't spend a lot of time after basic, except in high school. And so that was my training before I went to Vietnam. 3 weeks at Camp Pendleton, 8 weeks learning to be a plumber, and then flying to Vietnam commercial to join my battalion.
So which was more difficult, Navy training or high school?
High school was pretty tough. I went to a Catholic school, you got to remember. The nuns were worse than than some of the drill instructors. Basic training wasn't too good either. In the Navy, you used to have to wash your own clothes by hand with a bar of soap and a brush, and then you had to tie your laundry up with a special square knot, which was inspected the next day. So a lot of demerits, if you didn't know how to tie a square knot. But, my basic training was between my junior and senior year in high school.
Okay. So. We don't have experience with too many Navy people.
I'm not Navy.
He's a CV. Yeah.
But any questions? I have my hair. What do you mean? You mean in Vietnam?
Yeah.
I was in Khe Sanh. Okay. I was in I Corps, mostly I Corps, for 2 years. Yeah, well, we built all the Marine bases, so, any Marine base there. We built a lot of Army bases, too, the MPs, for the MPs where they kept the prisoners. The first tour, I was in Da Nang, but spent most of the time in Khe Sanh. Second tour in 68 was Quang Tri. Red Beach was our home port.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, awesome. Yay!
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Corporal Hiroshi Miyamura engaged Korean attackers in hand-to-hand combat. Details after this. Company H was occupying a defensive position when the enemy fanatically attacked, threatening to overrun the position. Miyamura, a machine gun squad leader, aware of the imminent danger to his men, jumped from his shelter, wielding his bayonet in close hand-to-hand combat, killing 10 of the enemy. Returning to his position, he administered first aid to the wounded and directed their evacuation. As another savage assault hit the line, he manned his machine gun and delivered withering fire until his ammunition was expended. He ordered the squad to withdraw while he stayed behind to render the gun inoperative. He then bayoneted his way through the infiltrated enemy soldiers to a second gun emplacement and assisted in its operation. When the intensity of the attack necessitated the withdrawal of the company, Miyamura ordered his men to fall back while he remained to cover their movement. He killed more than 50 of the enemy before his ammunition was depleted and he was severely wounded. He maintained his stand despite his painful wounds, continuing to repel the attack until his position was overrun. When last seen, he was fighting ferociously against an overwhelming number of enemy soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Throneberry, and this is a special program dedicated to the stories that we recorded on September 25th at our There I Was open mic for Veterans evening here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We hope that you will enjoy these stories, and if it's something that you're interested in, you can always send me an email to dale@veteransradio.net, and I'd be more than happy to tell you how we set up the program for you.
Wetzler, he was in the Army, Spec 5, 1967 to 1971. Welcome to, there I was. Have a seat.
Well, I'm not sure, thought a lot about this afternoon. Dug out a bunch of my old orders, tried to go through, remember dates and assignments and all that. But when I enlisted, I was going to be drafted. My dad had been WW2. They drafted him 3 times. He loved to tell the story, and they kept him the 3rd time because he was old. He was older. He ended up going to OCS and ended up in military intelligence, spent WW2 in Cairo, Egypt, with responsibility for Egypt and Northern Africa. and loved to tell this. He, with a big grin, never heard a shot fired in anger. And from the albums and stuff he brought back, Cairo was pretty good duty. So anyhow, I went down to the recruiter, asked about military intelligence. Well, we've got a deal for you. Army Security Agency. And at the time, we were the Army branch of the National Security Agency. At the time, NSA, you did not say those three words. They were black, their budget was black, and we did intercept, and my specialty was cryptology, encrypting messages to send secure messages. So I ended up at, I went to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey to signal school. And at first we had to learn how to fix teletypes. And you guys probably know what a teletype is. Very few do anymore. It produces the 7 or 5 punch tape. And that's how everything was done. It was keyed into those tapes. You fed the tape through a tape reader. The signal went through the crypto box and down the line. So we had to learn to fix teletypes first. Luckily, I was somewhat mechanically inclined and didn't have too much trouble with that. I don't remember how long that was. The signal school I went to was 36 weeks, which was very long. And we were in typewriter school, I'm guessing 6 or 8. And in order to graduate and go on to the crypto piece, they would bugger up a teletype, and you had to fix it in a certain amount of time and have it right. And then you graduated and went on to crypto school. Well, crypto school was the dawn of the integrated circuits. And we had a brand new, and I think it's 50 years, I think I can talk about this now. We had a brand new box called a KW7. It was about 18 inches every which way, square. It had circuit cards that plugged into the top, and it had an encoding, bunch of wires in the front where you set the code. On these circuit cards were flip-flops, transistors. They were the size of a pack of cigarettes, and they did one in and one out. And that was, man, brand new technology. That was solid state. So we learned to fix those, learned how to plug all the wires in the front to read a code, read the code, daily code, and then you had to send signals back and forth to the other end so they would sync and talk to each other, and then you could transmit the message. While I was there, I arrived in the fall of 67, and somebody had the great idea of we're going to play football. So tackle football. So I had played a little football in high school, and I thought, I got nothing else to do. Oh, my God. We went out there. It was brutal. A bunch of guys got hurt. I twisted my ankle, went to sick call, and the medic, the doc, he was furious. How did you injure yourself? Well, playing football, sir. He said, that's it. And it wasn't too long. That was the end of the football. Too many guys were getting banged up. God knows, well, we'd been to basic, so we thought we were in great shape, but we weren't in football shape, that was for sure. We lived in a big barracks on the second floor, and I think there were bays, squad bays at each end, and they had a small bay in the middle. That's where the Marines were. And you did not step into that Marine bay without a Marine inviting you in. Luckily, I kind of got to know one of the guys, so nobody would attack me if I went in there to talk to him. And it was a small group, about 6 or 8 Marines, and I just can't get over how they talked. None of them wanted to be there. This was brand new for the Marine Corps. They had nothing to do but get promoted and, you know, go up the ranks and all that with this crypto stuff. They all wanted to get the hell out of there, go to Nam and kill gooks. That's all they talked about. And I said, guys, you got to be kidding. And they would look at me like, hey, you Army guys, you know, afraid of a fight. And in fact, I think one or two of them deliberately tried to get kicked out so they could go to Nam. that part of the experience is somewhat seared in my memory. Other than that, it was a long school. Like I say, we did all this integrated circuit stuff and all the how to read the codes. God, I can't say it anymore, the Title 26 something United States Code, which means Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for life. They just beat it into you about security. You don't talk to anybody. How the women are going to come on to you and try and buy you drinks, and which never happened, of course. But they were very big on security. We had top secret. I had a top secret NATO clearance, and they were very, very concerned about security and just beat it into me. And I had a lot of respect for that. The old loose lips sink ships is definitely true. So that was basically my experience of Fort Monmouth, Kansas, Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, not too far from Red Bank, New Jersey. And there was another town that had a beautiful boardwalk. And I had a car. I was one of the few guys that had a car. I bought it from another guy that was leaving. I wish to God I would have kept it. It was a Buick. It was a beautiful car. And we would go out on the weekends. Of course, I couldn't drink. I was 18 or 19. Drinking ages were all 21. Couldn't go to any of the bars. So I would ride around, listen to the radio at night. And we slept on the boardwalk, slept on the beach a couple times in Red Bank. Went to New York City a couple times. When we ran out of money, we'd get in my car, go to the, what's the capital in New Jersey? Trenton. We'd go down to Trenton and sell our blood for a few bucks. So that was my experience. It is a 31S30 fixed station crypto repairman. Thank you. I learned right away. Well, of course, I'd been in for a year or so, so I was starting to figure this Army business out anyhow. There were four or five guys in the same training, crypto training, that were draftees. They had worked for IBM as computer guys. IBM tried to get them necessary deferments as because of their civilian work. Draft board said no, so IBM pulled strings, got those guys to crypto school, and they had about a year left when we were done at crypto school, and to a man, they went to Germany.
Oh, this is fun. Haven't had one of these stuffed in my face in a while. So, Skip Davis, I was drafted in 1967. At that point, I wound up becoming 11 Bravo, which many of us were once we were drafted. After I finished boot camp at Fort Benning, Georgia, I went on to jungle warfare school in the lovely Anniston, Alabama area, Fort McClellan. And it was one of the two tiger lands that was designated for jungle warfare training. The other one was Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Yes.
Anyone go to Fort Puke? There we go. So I had never ever handled any kind of a weapon system, even when I was growing up. My first weapon system I ever handled was, of course, the M14 rifle in boot camp. So I was lucky enough to go to AIT, if you can call it lucky, and learned all sorts of cool things: the 90 millimeter recoilless rifle, the M60 machine gun. What else did we play with? We played with the mortars. The law, yes. Light anti-tank weapon. That was pretty cool. And the grenade launcher. There we go. We got all these guys over here who know these weapon systems. So not only that, but in the day...
Stay on mic.
Oh, stay in the mic. Okay. So let me move that over. I don't need a chair. So in the day, they wanted to teach us cool things like quick kill with a rifle. So what do? They give you a BB gun, and you go out on a range, and they give you a disc that's probably this big around, and you'd hold it up so the guy would shoot it with the BB gun, so you just bring it up, pull the trigger. Well, of course, being kids, what do we start doing? Shooting each other in the ass with it. Now we'd cock it, fire someone in the butt. Well, so the whole thing with AIT was for me trying to avoid KP and weapons cleaning. So at the end of the day, when we burned up thousands of rounds with the M60s, our sergeants would call us together and go, okay, so we're going to have escape and evasion drill. So we would take off, and he would blow a whistle, and we'd run. And you'd try to find a place to hide. And I was really fast in that time, and I could always find a crevice to hide in. So we had a guy in our unit. He probably weighed about 200 pounds. So he crawls up this tree. And the drill was, if you got seen, one thing, but if you're up a tree, if you're up high enough and they couldn't touch you, no problem. So this guy gets in a sapling, and the sergeant's standing there. I still remember peeking over the top of the creek, and the sergeant stood just like this till this guy came right down and touched him. And it was hilarious. So the slow guys always got to wind up cleaning stuff. That's why I've always remained fast, and I still run. I still ruck to this day. But AIT was interesting. You never knew you're going to be using all that till you get to sunny Southeast Asia. You learn how to pack a beautiful ruck. You never knew you could carry 80 pounds on your back, not including the extra belts of ammunition. So I can see why hips, knees, and backs to this day are so wrecked. And I know quite a number of guys that were grunts in the packs they're carrying. When I did this last rucking event down in Detroit, the fundraiser, it was amazing. There were a bunch of young Marines carrying their rucks. And, of course, they're much nicer now than they were then. They actually conform
to your body.
They form to your body instead of your body forming to the metal ruck. But getting back to AIT again, we had another drill in which they were looking for people to paint the buildings, paint the bathrooms in our barracks. Every once in a while, they wanted to clean brand new clean walls and painting. So he blows the whistle. I take off running. And, of course, I hadn't been far outside of our particular area where our company was. And I almost felt like Wile E. Coyote as he's running. And all of a sudden, there's nothing but you and air, and you drop about 20 feet into a creek. But it was well worth it because, again, I skipped out on a detail. So needless to say, boot camp, I got stuck all the time. AIT, man, I was always good to go. So when we had a break, I never had to stay back. One of our drinking, when you're talking about drinking, the older guys got a hotel room in Anniston, Alabama, and two of the guys signed up for it. So how many guys show up? You get 10 guys in a room. And you give all of our money to the oldest guy who could buy booze. And we had quite a party that weekend in Anniston, Alabama. Guys sleeping in bathtubs, on the floor, in chairs. I never knew what a slow gin fizz was till I wound up going to AIT, and I thought, wow, this is some pretty great stuff. And then Southern Comfort. Those were smooth until you woke up the next morning. It just felt like you got blindsided. Mm-hmm. So after that, I went to NCO school, which I failed out because I wanted to. Went home for 30 days and then shipped out for sunny Southeast Asia. So that's my story of AIT.
And I'm sticking to it.
Hey, my story. I do good.
Any questions for Skip?
Okay.
All right. Don, you had a question? Hold on.
Yeah, I have a question. Don, 82nd Airborne.
Yeah, you still carry a ruck. I'm looking for guys who want to do rucking events with me for veterans awareness. You don't have to have a 50-pound ruck. I'll settle for 25 pounds. Anybody? Somebody? Yeah, you're all looking at me. What a crazy son of a bitch he is.
I can do that, and I get my sixth back surgery. Ah. did you, when you came back, were you involved in training at all?
When I came back, I kicked around with a lot of jobs. I wound up becoming a police officer for 42 and a half years. I just couldn't find something that seemed to fit my lifestyle. Of course, the camaraderie that we had being a grunt, not taken away from anyone else. The thing about being a grunt, which those of you that were, you shared your socks. You shared your last rations, your last clean pair of jungle fatigues. So when I finally got out of the military, I got asked if I wouldn't mind going into the Marine Corps. So I wound up, they let me lateral into the Corps with a 0311, which is their equivalent to a grunt, and I worked as an MP in a billet to be an MP, a reserve. I got out of there, and then at the age of 54, I went and enlisted in F425, the LERS unit out at Selfridge. I put in for an age waiver. I passed the basic bottom line entry for Ranger School doing the selection, but they still denied me being able to enlist, which kind of broke my heart because I could show them that at the age of 54 at the time, I could still do the Ranger walk, the 5 miles under 75 minutes with room to spare. But, hey, I still get to ruck. I enjoy those events. They pop up, and I'm good to go.
All right, thank you, Skip. Thank you very much. Don Beam is up here now. Don was in the Army from 68 to 69. He was in Vietnam. And, of course, 82nd Airborne, and he was a Sergeant E5. All right, Don, welcome back. Thanks.
Well, thank you. So AIT is kind of a subject that I went through three times. Once when I was in it. Second, when I came back, that's what I was an instructor on a grenade range and a Claymore mine range. And then about 8 years ago, I got invited by the U.S. Army to go down and do an evaluation with for an AIT group in 82nd Airborne. Spent the day with a colonel and a command sergeant major. So I got to see what my AIT was like, what it was like to implement AIT, and what it's turned into in the last 50 years, that time 42 years. So it was, I got through basic training, and I said, what's AIT? They said, are you going to AIT? They said, well, when you get there, ask. So, okay, so they shipped me off to Fort Lewis, Washington. They got Fort Lewis, Washington, and every instructor, every sergeant, every cook was a Vietnam returnee. Now, this plays into the AIT in that they had been there. So we were awestruck. We knew you could come back. You know, we knew with that training where we was going. So we're saying, okay. And so they took advantage of that, as I did when I was a trainer, is you will learn what you need to learn to survive from me, or I will bust you down and you will leave here. At that time, we had to draft. So there was no compunction about if you thought somebody couldn't make it or they didn't think you could make it, of busting you down, throwing you out. Was that kind of your experience? Exactly. You're going to Nam, so what are you going to do? So now the realization sets in, I'm going to Nam, so I better learn what the hell's going on too. So you pay attention. Whether you was drafted or whether you was enlisted or what the hell it was, once you know you're gone, they have your attention. It makes no difference. So when you get there, of course, you know, I was one of those guys in every group, as we all know, that has to ask that question when a drill sergeant says, are there any more questions? And I did that a time or two. Of course, got first day of orientation. I said, oh, what do we do in AIT? Well, hopefully we'll teach you how to find landmines without blowing yourself up. Hopefully we'll teach you how to fire a law without frying your partner. Hopefully we will teach you how to know which end of the M60 to use. Okay. So we're also going to teach you about, CBN, chemical, biological, nuclear, NBC, nuclear. And by this time I kind of shut up because we were supposed to be doing something else, but there was idiots like me asking questions. And I never forget one guy says, well, what's NBC stand for? And he says, nuclear, biological, chemical warfare. And So he says that was one of our first instructions. So the first day, we sat through a whole day of chemical, and they gassed us, threw a grenade in there, and the biological part about the hazmat suits and so on. And then the drill sergeant says, any more questions? Well, nobody said anything about nuclear. So, of course, any more questions? One guy asks us, and I'll never forget this, my first day. What about the nuclear part? Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you about that. In case of a nuclear attack, spread your legs a comfortable distance apart, bend over as far as you can at the waist, and kiss your ass goodbye. Any more questions? And that type of training was real intense. I mean, he really paid attention to map reading, the recoilless rifle, the grenade, all that was very, very intense. But we all pulled together, and majority of us made it. But it, the intensity of that type of thing, when you know where you're going, is something to experience. And then when I came back and I was teaching AIT, I felt empowered to do whatever it took to impress on that young man's mind what he needed to know. And I would go to extreme measures. For example, on the SCNE, when we got to, not only did I do the Claymore mine and the grenade, but I would help the guys on SCNE.
What is that?
Survival, escape, and evasion.
Thank you.
So we dug a hole, put a 55-gallon drum in it, found a lid and fit over it. And if we'd catch somebody out on SCNE, we, during the day, would catch and put snakes in there. We'd stuff the guy in there, throw the lid on, and stand on it. And there'd be a bunch of screaming and so on, and for a while we'd let them out. We threw one guy in there, nothing. We looked at each other, and we thought, he must have passed out, you know. We open up, he's a snake lover. He's in there, he's got snakes wrapped around his neck. So situations like that happen in that type of training, but it was very intense. I did learn, and it did save my life. I just don't know how to explain it. All the things that we learned and we retained, and we came back, right? It was great. Yeah, we did all that. In training, and I tell you, the consequences if you screwed up were by today's standard would be not only extreme but illegal as to what they did to us. No, really, they really would. You couldn't do to a trooper. They couldn't do to us nowadays. What happened back then? And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm saying it was an eye opener when I was through my third thing with AIT, spending a few days with the way they trained now, because it was so much more technical. You know, we had a line of sight, and I realized there that we were in the last line of sight war. We had to see something or somebody had to see us. In the AIT now, it's all over the horizon. It's so technical. There's a drone out there. The guy's got a laptop. He sees what's behind that rock with infrared. You know, this is it. And with us, it was out there bang, bang, what you can see. It was just so totally different. Totally different. That's where I was instructor at Fort Polk, Louisiana, in 69. So did you go to Fort McClellan for jungle warfare? No. The story on that is they said you're going to Panama for jungle warfare training. And I said, no, I've been in the Army 6 months. I'm a smart guy. I know I have to volunteer for that. So the E-7 said, well, yeah, you're right. Picks a stamp up, bam, Vietnam. So that's how I got my jungle training. That didn't work out anywhere near like I thought it was going to.
On the job training.
It was on the job training. That was the beginning of the on the job.
Always training. Works out really well. Well, all right, Don, thank you very much. Great. Great stuff. Guys are just.
Any questions?
Any other questions about escape and evasion? I think that's a topic for another program when we talk about our escape and evasion training. That never went well.
Yeah, and on top of my AIT, that was one of the things I did before the jungle warfare. I didn't realize it, is I had a solid week of SCNE in the mountains out there also, which was in preparation, I guess, while I was waiting to go to Panama, which I never made.
Good. That's lucky. Thank you. Thanks very much, Don. Thank you all very much for coming out again. I really love this whole concept of hearing your stories, and please get some other folks to come on out, and we'll come up. Help us ideas. What ideas? What themes would you like us to talk about? I know we're going to do an escape and evasion one. That one will be in there at some point, because we all really probably all got, well, the majority of us got caught. Some of us were lucky enough to get out of that. But thanks for coming out. Thank your significant others for letting you come out. And I'm just going to turn this off, and then we'll be done with it from there. So thanks for listening. You've been listening to Veterans Radio.